And he noticed that rents in these what would be considered luxury houses in North Harlem were not that much higher than they were for the slum areas of Hell's Kitchen. So he went through his contacts and he said to people, well, I can get you a better place. You can live in Harlem in the luxury area of the Justice Jewish area. And they must have said, are you kidding? We can't live there. And he said, yes, I can. My name is Jim Kaplan. I'm a longtime Manhattan walking tour historian. I'm also the chairman of the Lower Manhattan Historical Association, and I'm also a past vice president of the Temple of Universal Judaism. Today, my talk relates to really the Black Jewish Alliance Against Discrimination. It was perhaps influenced by my going to our Passover Seder, which really is the story of the flight of the Jews out of slavery in Egypt 4,000 years ago. And I've always wondered why we don't tell another, perhaps equally interesting story about the fight here in New York City 100 years ago.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Our New York City correspondent Jim Kaplan is with us. His story today explains how Jews and Blacks came together in New York City, among other things, to develop the community of Harlem, but also to combat prejudice. You talk about Joseph and Jesse Seligman and Philip Peyton and the Black Jewish Alliance in the first decade of the 20th century and how they revolutionized race relations in New York City. How does this story from 100 years ago relate to the Passover, which took place thousands of years ago?
Well, let me start with Joseph and Jesse Seligman, who were actually a little before Peyton. They were Jewish immigrants to New York from Germany, and they had a prominent textile. They were originally itinerant peddlers and turned into a fairly prominent textile firm around right before the Civil War, and they bought an extensive factory in Brooklyn in 1859. And when the Civil War hit in the 1861, the Union Army needed a lot of uniforms and things like that. And they were, after the defeats at the Battle of Bull Run, there were many merchants who were unwilling to finance them, but the Seligmans were not. They fell all in to finance the Union Army, firstly with uniforms, and then later they branched out into to finance and to raise funds for the Union Army. So right after the Civil War, Joseph and Jesse Seligman were the most prominent Jewish businessmen on Wall Street, and really were credited as being financiers of the Northern effort in the Civil War and close associates of Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant. They were in many ways the most prominent Jews in New York and considered to be very patriotic. And every summer they would bring their families with a residue of servants to stay at the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga Springs, New York, which was probably the most prominent resort in New York State. However, they considered themselves to be as American as apple pie and great supporters of the United States, and it never occurred to them that they would face anti-Semitism, even though at the time there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish immigrants coming from Russia fleeing the pogroms. But from their point of view, they were at the pinnacle of New York and American society. However, in 1879, the new manager of the Saratoga Hotel, a man named Henry Hilton, announced to them that they couldn't stay there because they had the Grand Union Hotel had a new policy that henceforth no Jews would be allowed to stay there. Mm. The Seligmans were absolutely outraged and took out newspaper articles denouncing this policy. And although their effort attracted some considerable support from prominent Christian clergymen, such as Henry Ward Beecher. In essence, Judge Hilton stood his ground, said that he could rent to anybody, he could have anybody he wants stay or not stay at his hotel, and many of his customers and many of his weren't happy about having Jews like the Seligman stay there, and therefore the policy would be that no Jews would be allowed. The Seligman's effort to overturn this anti-Semitic policy basically failed. There was no Hilton insisted that as a private owner he could stay permit whoever he wanted to stay in the hotel, and as a result, in fact, Hilton's policy of not admitting Jews in upstate New York hotels was later followed by many hotels upstate, so that Jews were restricted to specialized hotels in the Catskills and elsewhere. Furthermore, as the 1870s went on, Jews began to be excluded from many previously Gentile residential neighborhoods in Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Queens. In particular, one of the most odious things was that they would have covenants in the deeds of certain neighborhoods saying that no Jews were allowed, and that would be a selling point for those communities. So the situation for Jews and anti-Semitism really got worse in the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s. Mm-hmm. And many Jews at the time criticized Joseph and Jesse Seligman for their boisterous opposition to Judge Hilton's anti-Semitic policies. They argued that it to stand up to anti-Semitism just made things worse. Mm. The Seligmans, however, believed that if this is what anti-Semites could do to the wealthiest and most established Jews in New York, how would the poor Russian immigrants fleeing the pogroms in Tsarist Russia expect to be treated? So by about 1900, the situation for there was in essence an upsurge of anti-Semitism throughout New York State. And the Seligmans reportedly died, Joseph in 1880 and Jesse in 1894, disappointed about their failure to defeat anti-Semitism and pessimistic about the future of the Jews in New York City.
But there was one Manhattan neighborhood that continued to welcome Jews.
Yes, ironically, one of the only or the major upscale neighborhood from which Jews were not restricted was Harlem. Harlem, by 1890, became the second largest Jewish neighborhood in the city, where the wealthier Jews who moved out of the Lower East Side came, and really the fourth largest Jewish community in the country. That was where the Bernheimers, people like the Seligmans, lived. Harlem was a flourishing upper middle class Jewish community where they were building large houses, etc. You might say Harlem was the major Jewish enclave or upper class Jewish enclave. And there were no blacks in Harlem at the time. Around this time, there was also, however, very significant discrimination against blacks in the city, despite the end of slavery. In fact, things in the post-slavery South with Jim Crow policies and segregation got worse and worse with the end of Reconstruction and the withdrawal of federal troops. So that a number of blacks, most of whom lived in the South, began migrating to New York City. And it was not a huge number, but and it's been some blacks here, some of whom had been free, but also been subject to severe discrimination in voting and other things. And the majority of these blacks were restricted to a slum area on the west side of Manhattan called San Juan Hill, which is today's Hell's Kitchen, around 57th Street, where they lived in dilapidated housing in close proximity to Irish immigrant poor. In 1900, after a black resident stabbed a young white off-duty Irish policeman, Irish residents of Hell's Kitchen essentially rioted and started attacking blacks. And for many of the Jews, this was very similar to the pogroms in Russia. Although they were sympathetic, but what could they do about it? I mean, after all, they had their own problems. Thus, by the turn of the 20th century, the situation of blacks in New York City could hardly have been worse in a way. And except for segregation in the South, It could not have been worse nationally.
What changed the situation in the early 1900s?
Well, one of the most amazing things was there was, in a way, there was a natural alliance between Jews and blacks in the against discrimination. The man who really fostered it, I remember the Seligmans were dead at this time, was a young black man named Philip Peyton. Mr. Peyton was a college dropout from Westfield, Massachusetts, where he was from an upper class, you might say a middle class or upper middle class black family. His father was a barber, and his two brothers went to Yale, which is very unusual at the time. On the other hand, Phil was kind of the black sheep of the family. He dropped out of school. You know, they didn't know quite what to do with him. And about the age of 21, he moved to New York City to try to travel and got a job as a janitor and real estate agent in a Hell's Kitchen real estate company. He was a very unlikely fellow to change the history of the city of New York and perhaps the country, although in my opinion, he did. And he's not very well known today. After taking a course sponsored by Booker T. Washington's Black Business League, so a Negro entrepreneurship, he quit his job with the real estate company to go off on his own and established a company called Philip A. Peyton, catering to colored tenants. The only problem was he didn't have any clients, he didn't have any tenants, and he didn't have any landlords. So since he had nothing to do, he would walk around and walk up to Harlem, supposedly, he said, because he didn't have the 5-cent subway fare. And he noticed that in the very north end of Harlem, they had overbuilt, and therefore there were certain houses or brownstones that were not able easily to find tenants. Apparently, according to him, there was one, he came across a real estate developer in the north and a real estate owner who was fighting with a contract owner, and they must have seen Peyton's flyer or whatever, and they said, you think you could bring black tenants up here to my building, despite his neighbor? And Peyton said, well, I think I might be able to, having had contact in the Hell's Kitchen area, knowing that actually, and he noticed that actually the rents in these what would be considered luxury houses in North Harlem were not that much higher than they were for the slum areas of Hell's Kitchen. So he went to through his contacts, and he said to people, well, I can get you a better place. I can get you, you can live in Harlem, in the luxury area of the Justly Jewish area. And they must have said, are you kidding? We can't live there. And he said, yes, I can, because Hayden had a lease with this landlord where he would sublease to various tenants. So he brought up one group, and that was very successful from their point of view, and it was very successful from the landlord's point of view, because the landlord now had a full building and he was paying rent, which none of his neighbors did. So other people on the block saw this, and they said, hey, you know, we should get in on this too. So pretty soon, Mr. Hayden had four or five buildings on 134th Street, which were fully rented, and they thought that, well, gee, you know, that this is really not a bad deal. For the neighbors in the Jewish neighbor, or the Jewish and non-Jewish neighbors in the area, the idea that suddenly blacks were moving in from Hell's Kitchen, the poor blacks, to live in the elite Jewish neighborhood of Harlem was rather unsettling.
There was an organization that was formed that was in opposition to what Philip Peyton was doing, getting blacks to live in Harlem.
Yes, what happened was a company went to Mr. Peyton and they offered him a fairly high price to buy out all his leases, which he thought was great because, you know, this was more money than he'd ever seen. He was about to be evicted when he started 2 or 3 years ago. Until he discovered that they were the agent for something called the Harlem Protective Owners Association, and they immediately began evicting the black tenants from his buildings that he brought up. So the tenants said to Phil, what'd you do to us? I mean, and the idea was that They would then ask the Harlem Protective Zoners Association, then asked landowners throughout Harlem to have covenants in their deeds that no blacks would be allowed, just as those restrictions were against the Jews in other parts of the city. You know, in that way, they said, well, we'll keep squelch early this effort to bring blacks to Harlem.
Peyton found an ally for his efforts. How did that work out?
There was at least one landlord, a firm called Casella Goldberg, which was apparently on the block or across the street, and they said, hey, you know, well, this is, I don't think, we're not going to sign on to this to keep blacks out of Harlem when these are the covenants that are keeping us out of many areas of the city. And this is the reason why discrimination, how are we ever going to break out of discrimination in the Bronx areas of Brooklyn if we say that the blacks can't, we do the same thing to the blacks here in Harlem. We're not signing on. So it was, Page apparently heard about them, and they heard about Peyton, and they offered to sell to Peyton buildings right across the street from the buildings in which Peyton's people were evicted. So what happened was that Peyton bought these buildings, and he immediately began evicting the white tenants in those buildings. Now, if there hadn't been a stir when there were blacks moving into Harlem in these areas, the fact that a black realtor would evict white tenants and essentially fight with the connivance or the coalition of a Jewish landlord, the attempts to keep blacks out of Harlem, really got people interested throughout the city. And what happened was that Peyton, in essence, the Harlem Protective Zoners Association failed to keep the blacks off that block because they ultimately had to sell the buildings back to Peyton. This was a tremendous victory for a young man in his mid-20s, Philip Peyton, and created quite an interest even in the black community throughout the black leadership. They called Mr. Peyton in and they said, what's going on here? Mr. Peyton, do you know what you're doing? You're going to attack, try to bring blacks and attack the major Jewish neighborhood in this city? I mean, if you tried this in the South, they would lynch you. And Peyton said, apparently, well, look, you guys don't understand what's going on here. This is the North. These Jews aren't worried about aren't going to lynch us. They're more worried about being lynched themselves. You should make comment. You've got to back me up. You said you want to get out of the kitchen and so-called leadership. Stand with me. Support me. And we'll be able to break the covenants. We'll be able to break out of Hell's Kitchen into a much better neighborhood. And apparently, Peyton's pitch, perhaps with some skepticism to the black leadership, carried the day. It may even have been said that Booker T. Washington was a key factor in supporting this. So what they did was they formed a company called the Afro-American Realty Company. The Afro-American Realty Company was capitalized with $500,000. They would be the directors. Peyton was essentially the president. And they would begin buying properties in Harlem, and they advertised blacks throughout the city that this is race economics. We're going to make money with this. We'll try to get you back 10% return. This is a fantastic deal. In essence, the fight was on. There was pretty soon Peyton had 20 buildings under ownership, probably 1,500 to 2,000 blacks. We're soon living previously the elite center of the elite Jewish community of Harlem. Most Jews probably opposed it, but there were some, like Casella and Goldberg, who probably thought, well, this is a good thing, because if we can beat the covenants here at Harlem, we can beat them throughout the city. And there was a New York Times article in 1904, which entitled Race War Erupts in Harlem, and it describes the operations of the Afro-American Realty Company. It would buy up buildings They would try to keep tenants in, but if they had to, they would evict white tenants. So they could bring in blacks, essentially from Hell's Kitchen and the other areas of Harlem. By 1907, Booker T. Washington, in his review of black businesses in the country, hailed the Afro-American Realty Corporation and Mr. Payton as the most important, one of the most important black businesses in the country, and Mr. Payton, at the age of 27 or 28, as one of the leading black businessmen in the country, a perfect example of his idea of Negro entrepreneurship and Negroes standing on their own, which was, you know, his philosophy, as opposed to others who looked for charity from white people. Unfortunately, by 1908, Payton, who was an exuberant young fellow, you can understand having, you know, had such success at a very young age, got overextended in his efforts, and there was a recession in the city's real estate, which there is from time to time. And unfortunately, the Afro-American Realty Company went under. It was not able to meet its obligations, and there were lawsuits against Payton. It was accused of fraud, etc. So that, in a sense, was a big defeat. But his efforts were continued by some of his lieutenants, John B. Nail and others, working with the better-capitalized black churches to continue to buy properties in Harlem. And even though the Afro-American Realty Company had gone under to the great distress, I'm sure, of many of the people who'd invested in it, blacks invest with high hopes, it really, in my sense, had a much greater success in that it was able to essentially develop Harlem as a black community. At one point, the Harlem Protective Owners Association said, "Well, why don't we have a truce? You'll live in certain areas, and we'll live in others, and we'll have covenants in our areas." And basically, they said to him, "No way. The time of covenants in this city are over." And they bought a major piece of property on 135th Street, which was called the Million Dollar Houses, probably opting through white agents, or they reportedly paid way over the market price. But that broke the back, in essence, of the Harlem Protective Owners Association, which then collapsed. And after that, blacks stood free in Harlem, and Harlem became a predominantly black community.
And then the news spread about what was happening with race relations in Harlem.
Yeah, what happened was, you know, at the time that the Ku Klux Klan was riding high in the South, and Woodrow Wilson was watching the film Birth of a Nation in the White House, a word would spread throughout the South. There was one place where the attempts to keep blacks and the attempt discrimination against blacks had been beaten partially with their Jewish allies. It had been beaten in this new community, this formerly Jewish community up in New York City called Harlem. And Harlem would become, and many people would begin to buy one-way tickets up to Harlem, and they would, to some extent, even depopulate parts of the South, because people heard that, you know, this is a different world up here. Harlem would become the social, economic, and political center of the black community in the United States, some would even say in the world, and the excitement of having a community where they didn't have to worry about Ku Klux Klan or discrimination, but could develop themselves and develop their own cultural ideas, which spawned the Harlem Renaissance and totally change race relations in the city of New York, particularly. And many Jews, although there were probably many Jews who were upset that this great Jewish neighborhood of Harlem had now become gone to the blacks, I think there were probably others like Caselli Goldberg who thought it was a very good thing, because very quickly the religious restrictions, the restrictions against Jews would fall. And this alliance between the blacks and Jews would essentially overcome the discrimination of the previous 25 years. So I think the political and social implications of this cannot be underestimated. ultimately, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People would be formed with people like W.B. Du Bois and funded by people like Julius Rosenwald, who was the Sears Roebuck. And this alliance between blacks and Jews against discrimination would become very powerful and ultimately would move back into the South. Rosa Parks, for example, was an NAACP organizer in Montgomery, Alabama, and this would become the center of the fight against discrimination against blacks and Jews throughout the country, and to many respects remains to this day. I think that this history is unfortunately not as widely understood today as it should be.
Like Philip Payton is not really remembered today, and Jewish company that helped him out, Cassell and Goldberg, either.
There's no plaque to Payton in Harlem. There's no very little recognition of him. I mean, some historians, as you may recall, I did a podcast for you about 3 years ago on Philip Payton and the Afro-American Realty Company. Virtually nothing is known about Cassell and Goldberg. I haven't been finding anything about them or who they were. Other than that they sold their buildings to Payton, I have no idea who they were, really, or what their real motivations are. The fight, the alliance between blacks and Jews against discrimination would be quite important. Ultimately, racial and restrictive covenants would be outlawed in this state, and Harlem would become one of the major economic centers and in alliance with many Jewish entrepreneurs. So I think the implications of this are extremely broad and extremely to this day. And it's too bad. Even now, the Seligmans, who were the leading businessmen, Jewish businessmen of the 1870s and 80s, their empire kind of was eclipsed, you might say, by other financial firms like Goldman Sachs, like J.P. Morgan and others. And they're hardly known today, too, Joseph and Jesse Seligman. And if they're known at all, it's for their fight, their stance, their unsuccessful against anti-Semitism stemming out of the Grand Union Hotel incident. Mm-hmm. So I think both these things are events and people who should be more widely known. I mean, we talk about the flight 4,000 years ago of the Jews out of Egypt, but I think this is perhaps as interesting a story and not one which should be better known, in my opinion.
I hope you can give to our Historians Podcast Fund Drive. You can go to our website and link to GoFundMe. You can also send a check made out to me, Bob Cudmore, to 125 Horseman Drive, Scotia, 12302. Thank you. Jim Kaplan has joined us on the Historians Podcast, a tax, estate, and guardianship lawyer, founding partner of the Midtown New York City law firm of Greenberg and Kaplan. He's also a walking tour historian of New York neighborhoods, including Lower Manhattan and also Harlem, and a co-founder and past president of the Lower Manhattan Historical Association. And he's a former vice president, long-term board member of the Temple of Universal Judaism. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.